You want to do it, nor do you.
We have a quorum now, so we'll bring this committee meeting to order. We do have a few minutes to adopt.
Madam Chair, I have read the March 21st minutes and will move approval of those.
Okay. Any questions, comments, changes to be recommended to the minutes for March
21.
Okay. All those in favor of the March 21 minutes, say aye.
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 All those opposed? Minutes adopted. Anybody like to move the March 23rd minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Diskins moves the March 23rd minutes. Any concerns, recommendations for changes? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor of the March 23rd minutes, say aye.
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 All those opposed? Minutes adopted. March 28th minutes.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Representative Seibert moves the March 28th minutes. Any changes recommended, questions, comments?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Just to make sure that adjourned is spelled correctly in the closing, where Representative Dietrich adjourned. You need an R.
Madam Chair, I just want to let the record show that I did catch that, but I thought it was a minor detail.
Okay, Representative Sandra Erickson recommends it adjourn the spelling of it on page 83 of the March 28th minutes, that we add an R after the U and have that spelled correctly. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposition to spelling adjourned correctly? Okay, thank you. ignore. Okay. March. Okay, that's adjourned is not spelled correctly. That's adopted. And now we move to approving the entire minutes for March 28th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay, adopted. It's adopted. Okay, now we move to our agenda for the day, which is House File 3623. And we'll move, I think that we'll take that, that's just been laid over, and we'll bring it back here today. Move House File H3623 be brought before the committee. And Representative Meslow, I believe you have an amendment to put it in a form that you would like to have it discussed in.
I do, Madam Chair. At this time, I am asking that the H3623DE3 amendment come before the committee. If someone would move that amendment at this time.
We do that.
Representative Heigerken has a question before we do that.
Yes,
Representative Heigerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And at this time, I think I've got a higher motion. I make a motion that we keep the old language. We go ahead with the bill as law presently stands. No amendments. Your language would stand. The law that's in the book would stand.
Okay. So the motion then is to... We do have an amendment already adopted onto this particular bill. And I wonder if we can backtrack, and I guess I need counsel on that.
Madam Chair? I'm a little ignorant. Could I have maybe Representative Heiger can explain what that does? Because I'm just unaware of how this works, and maybe you could explain it to me.
Okay, and Representative Diskins may have to help us a little bit with, but my motion is we're going to keep the present law that is being used, and that refers to the way the formula works, everything else. There's no changes in present law. The law that we have in the book would be the law that I am proposing right now that we go ahead with the new funding money coming in. No changes.
Madam Chair?
Representative Diskins?
Madam Chair, I believe Representative Heidgerken, the appropriate motion to do that would be to table the bill. Are you making
Representative Heidgerken, are you motioning to table the bill?
If that is the appropriate way to do it, I make the motion to table the bill.
Debate to that, Representative
I don't think it's debatable, Madam Chair.
Okay.
So I don't understand why you wouldn't just vote to delete one area if that's what upsets you. Why would you vote to sink the whole bill?
I don't believe this is a debatable motion, so with the motion before us to table the bill, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Division?
Okay. Division being called. All those in favor, please raise your hand. All those opposed. Okay. Well, please, all those in favor, raise your hand again, please. Thank you. All those opposed.
I'm not on the
Okay, there being 8 ayes and 11 nays, the motion does not prevail. Okay, to the Representative Sakura, would you like to move amendments?
I would move
3623DE3 before the committee.
Money.
Yes, I'm even looking at the wrong amendment. I'm not sure. Okay. Yes, I would move A1 to be before the committee and be referred to finance when passed. Okay. Pardon? Oh, first we have to adopt the amendment.
Would you like to move the DE3 amendment?
Oh, DE3. I've got the wrong amendment. Okay. Okay. I'll move DE3. Sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay. Representative Meslow, to your new version of the bill, to this amendment, the DE3.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Last Friday afternoon, when we were here talking about the bill, I described it at the time as a work in progress. What I would tell you is that since Friday, there has been much work, and I believe there has been a great deal of progress. I believe there is still more work to do, and I'll talk about some specific areas where I think that's true. But I think we have a very strong bill here, and in identifying that, I need to call out some people who deserve a good deal of credit for that situation. That starts with Committee Chair Representative Biskins, who really gave us some time on this bill, and I appreciate the process that you have allowed us to follow in this. We could have rushed to a vote last Friday, and I don't know whether it would or would not have passed at that time, but we would not have had the same quality product that you will now have the opportunity to consider today, and so I appreciate the opportunity to do that. And we were first moved to Tuesday and then got a couple more days to improve the product yet more, and I appreciate that greatly. We got tremendous help from the Governor's Office and the Department of Education, in particular Margaret Vessel, Michelle Weber, Karen Carlson, played a big role in what we've got here. As we walk through the bill, you'll see changes that occur in sections 1 through 6, and those are largely based upon inspiration given by Representative Dorn that we were able to carry forward. And as we get to the subsequent questions after that, today's committee chair, Representative Klinzing, has her fingerprints over every page, I would say virtually every line of that, with tremendous suggestions and ideas that have improved this. And so I'm delighted that the DE3 is being offered, but whether I'm the person who deserves credit for it, I'll tell you the answer to that question is definitively no. I'm not. But I'm very pleased. Lastly, I would be remiss if I didn't single out Lisa Larson for the tremendous work that she has done as we have given her draft after draft and said, no, we'd like this a little different yet one more time. And that's a big part of why things are so strong now. Again, I will tell you, not finished, but Very nice product.
Representative Meslow, while you're pointing out Lisa Larson, our counsel to the committee, she would like to make a technical change that happened in her drafting. She'd like to suggest an amendment.
Madam Chair, Representative Meslow, on the document H3623DE3 on page 7, line 10, after the period, insert 4. And on page 7, line 14, delete grants 2. And on page 7, line 15, delete extend. Thank you.
I'd like to do that one more time.
Okay. I'll move that amendment to be amended to put the form of the DE3 amendment that it needs to be into. All those in question to that? Representative Wardlow would like to have that repeated, please. Thank you, Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, Representative Wardlow, on the document H3623DE3, page 7. On page 7, line 10, after the resources period, insert 4. And on page 7, line 14, delete grants 2. And on page 7, line 15, delete extend.
Any questions about this amendment to the DE3 amendment? Okay, seeing no questions, all those in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, Representative Meslow, to your amendments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, I'd like to walk you through what the DE3 amendment does and tell you what the bill says as we sit here today. Sections 1 through 6, you will recall, redistributed some Head Start money. There's a formula that's been in place since 1989, and that formula in part has a base amount that has gone to areas around the state and to programs around the state. That's 50% of that formula. The second 50% has been based upon need as measured by poverty level within each of those areas and programs. The bill that we were looking at on Friday removed the base part of that and based it 100% on need. What that did was keep the same total dollars but redistributed that based upon the need, and the concept behind that was to make sure that there was a consistency and a balance throughout the state. We had some good committee discussion on that, and part of what became clear in that committee discussion is that there is a reliance on the level of funding that has existed that I hate to fully undercut, and also that in some cases, while Head Start monies may be underserved in some parts around the state, there are other programs that may help fill those gaps. So what we did in the D3 amendment, if you go through sections 1 through 6, is that we shifted the percentages in the calculation. Instead of being half base and half need, or under the other proposal, which was going to be 100% need, it's now one-third base, two-thirds need. So that's what the amendment does in sections 1 through 6. I've had some good conversation with people. I intend that those conversations will continue. I'll note that the Senate version of their early childhood bill actually retains the 50-50 formula that is already in place now. But I think this is a good place for us to be today. I will continue to listen to people. That was one of the great things about Friday, was the opportunity to listen and try to incorporate some very good thoughts people had. So that's what sections 1 through 6 do. Section 7.
I'm sure.
Hey, Representative Piker.
Before we take the whole bill in, I would like to go through it line by line, section by section, not part by part. Going over, we had some mention of property level. It's interesting to note that all of a sudden we want to bring total property values in, and Representative Sharon, this is perhaps where you and I may differ. I think the one that, if we're going to do it, let's look at the whole formula of the state of Minnesota, how we fund kids. Let's do a statewide property tax on all the property in the state of Minnesota and divide the money up equally to all the kids. We want to be fair. That'd be the fair way to do it. Each kid gets so much money. And if we're going to be using that as part of the distribution of this funding, I think we should use it throughout the entire formula that we use. I mean, it would be a fair way of funding kids. But again, I want to, I need to understand how the property levels came in on it. Are we using the property levels we use to pass referendums? For example, out my districts, only an acre and a half of the farm property is subject to taxation. All the lake cabins are not subject to taxation on referendums. Are we using that, guys, in figuring out how the Head Start monies are using? Or are we using what we should be using for our formula, statewide property tax, divide the monies up to the kids? And if you want to use the income barriers, we could do that. And we could come up with the Wendy Anderson miracle right here now. With that, I'd like to see how the property levels are figured in.
Representative Meswell.
Madam Chair, Representative Heidgerken, this bill doesn't have anything to do with property levels. That's not a part of sections 1-6. This is poverty level, which is a whole different question, and so property level is not a factor in these calculations at all.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Heidgerken, it typically is the courtesy of this committee to allow an author to present the bill in the way that he would like to, and then we'll dissect it
okay.
Because it is very important that every member look at every piece. This is an important piece, and I know you're passionate about this, Representative Heidgerken, but typically as a courtesy to the author of the bill, we allow them to present it in the shape they would like.
Representative Meswell, continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, as we go to Section 7, we've clarified that what we're talking about in Section 7, there are two things we've done with Section 7. The first one is to clarify that what we're talking about is resources for new parents. And I think that changes the tenor of what we're talking about. Education, I think, inferred that we were saying that new parents don't know what they're doing. We've all got a lot to learn. But what we're really talking about is providing resources that new parents can then decide will or will not be helpful to them as they move forward. The second thing that we did with Section 7 is to emphasize that the resources that the state can provide to do that, and this has to do with, how old are most kids, walking, talking, those kinds of things, those kinds of very basic types of things. Some hospitals, cities, and counties are already providing that information. We're not looking to replace that, supplant anything that's out there. It's to coordinate what's there. And at very low cost to the state, nominal cost of $80,000, it's simply a resource that we would be making available to parents. Sections 8 through 10 address access to early childhood programs. Section 8 provides access for parents who might also be daycare providers. And the challenge for those parents, and by parents I mean, in order to be eligible for this, you have to have a preschool-aged child in your family. You have to be the parent of a preschool-aged child. And many of those people are providing daycare, oftentimes in-home daycare, and are unable to attend any of the early childhood family education programs that are offered throughout the day because they've got other children who are there. What we say here is that it's all right to be able to come to that, to bring up to six children as you do that, and the fees would have to be paid for children as they did that. But to allow them to participate in ECFB programs if they so desire. It then becomes the decision of that individual if he or she wants to ask the parents of the other children in their daycare location to pay for their cost in the ECFE program, of attending the ECFE program, or if this person wants to pick up the cost for all of them because he or she finds it valuable enough to do it that way, that's really going to be their call. But what we're just saying is we're swinging the door open a little wider and giving them the opportunity to participate. That kind of theme continues as you look at sections 9 and 10. And what we do with section 9 and 10 is indicate that in coming to ECFE, it's not strictly limited to parents, but that other relatives are also able to come. And we define that as grandparents or other person related by blood, marriage, adoption, or foster placement. So we're simply saying that grandma or grandpa could come and participate in an early childhood program with grandson or granddaughter, that kind of a situation. Again, providing more opportunity, and I think that's a very good thing. Section 12 talks about it empowers the commissioner to retain an independent contractor to do some analysis, and this comes out of substantial discussion that we've had here. And that was as we looked at ways that we can provide information to parents and let them know different things that are available at these child care alternatives. Certainly there has been much talk about what's referred to as the quality rating system. The governor's original bill, the original bill that we looked at Friday, didn't adopt the QRS program and instead adopted what the governor referred to in his press conference as an Apple program, something a little less formalized than QRS, something that would have broader applicability to less formal child care centers, and simply a certificate, a stamp of approval saying there's education that's being taught here as a part of this child care location, whatever it is. As I listened to the committee, and as we've had more dialogue since, frankly, we're not ready to go forward with implementing a rating system as we sit here today. And so what the bill does is empowers the commissioner to retain an independent contractor to take a look at those questions and to say, is there a way to develop a user-friendly rating system that would provide good information to parents? And further, as that's looked at, to even ask the question, is it a good thing for us to do that? Because we have to consider that there are going to be intended and unintended consequences of that, that there will be some people, some locations that will not qualify for whatever that stamp of approval is, and that they and the people who use that, the families that use those locations, may be adversely impacted by a rating system. So what we're trying to do with this is not to prejudge. This is what a rating system should be, or indeed even that a rating system is a good thing. We're saying let's get some experts to take a look at this, come back and report to us by March 1st, and tell us what a good idea would be, and make sure that we're getting that expert opinion before we jump forward and make a commitment. So that's what we're doing in Article 12. In the appropriations, there is $500,000 that's appropriated to conduct that study. Article 13, let me back up for just a moment. I'll tell you that Article 12 is part of what needs to be reworked, because if you look at the top of page 6, I think that the language, first of all, is weighted to say it's going to be a program and a suggestion that it's a more formalized process that it's going to take in order to get a stamp of approval. And I also think that Article 6 indicates that it's a given that some kind of certification process will be required. That's not my intention. I'll tell you that I've done kind of a quick and dirty modification to that, but and if committee members have great concern about that, I can offer that as an oral amendment today, but I will tell you it is quick and dirty, and to truly get it right, if this bill moves forward, we'll be in front of Education Finance on Tuesday, and I would continue to work with all of the players, including Ms. Larson, who would do a far better job of drafting some language that encompasses our intention. And so my preference would be not to mess with that language today. If there are comfort level issues with that on the committee, if you have trouble trusting that I'm really going to make those changes, then let's make them today. And I don't have a problem with that at all. There would be no offense at that. But I want to let you know that I don't think the language right now entirely does what it is that I intend it to do. Now, with that, I want to move to Section 13. Section 13 establishes a readiness assessment to determine whether children are ready for school and provides money to assist the children who appear not to be ready. Then provides a reassessment for those kids at the end of kindergarten to determine whether the efforts to prepare them were in fact successful. You'll recall that the language of Section 13 on Friday included a lot of talk about social and psychological and those kinds of issues. I don't believe that is a part of Section 13 now, and it's my intention that it would not be. I know that change will please some members of the committee, will displease other members of the committee, but I want to be very upfront in that modification. Section 14 then deals with the appropriations. There is the $80,000 that goes for the new parent materials. I'm going to skip down for a moment to set subdivision 4. That's the $500,000 for the study regarding any certification process. There's a little, in subdivision 5, there's a little under $2 million, $1.9, that is for that intervention for the kids who we think aren't going to be ready, provide the opportunity to give them some intervention, and then check the success of that afterwards. And then I'll back up, and you'll see that in part by not implementing a rating system, in large part by not implementing that immediately, there is money that's freed up that the governor has made available for early childhood, and that's exactly what we do, is we put it into the early childhood programs. That actually leaves us with $7 million that we can invest in our early childhood programs statewide. Initially, the language that you'll see there reflects that as grants. It's not intended as grants. That would be aid, and it would be distributed consistent with the existing program, existing formula for early childhood programs. So that kind of takes you through where we're at with the bill. These are substantial changes, and that's why I thought it would be necessary to walk through everything with the committee. But I'm very happy to address any questions or concerns the committee members might have.
Discussion to the amendment. Questions for Representative Nussbaum. Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to make an amendment. And I have passed out a written oral amendment. And in discussion with staff, they would like to improve my written oral amendment. Let me tell you what I'm trying to do, and then we'll hear the technical way. I think that putting the Head Start funding on a needs base kind of makes sense, a lot of sense, as a matter of fact. In the original plan, I think Anoka donated 4 of its slots to Ramsey, pretty much, it seems like, and county, which I think is a great place to put it where the needs are. And I think that putting things on a need basis statewide is the best way to go. The Senate didn't do anything with this, and you can tell there's already controversy about this matter. And rather than have it fall off the table altogether and not move the ball forward, I think that if we can at least create a two-tiered, two pools of money system, that way there'll be less harm to some of the programs that would be outstate in particular. And then the Metro could at least deal with itself. And I don't even know how the runs work out, but I think as a policy basis, I think that the committee could be asked, do we suggest that we, at least on a regional basis, go with a need-based allocation or not? And I would suggest that we say yes to that. The amendment that I'm bringing forward would create two zones, the Metro and non-Metro, and this is going to go a long ways yet, so this is just a placeholder for further discussion. It may just be decided that maybe Duluth is a metro, or whatever comes out of that, but at least this will move the ball forward for today to get that going. And I think Ms. Larson has an amendment that I actually will move what Lisa is going to say right now as my amendment as opposed to what's in front of you.
Okay. Ms. Larson?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, members, on the document H3623DE3, page 1, line 23, after the period, insert the one-third and two-third allocations must be separately calculated for and distributed to the 7-county metropolitan area and outstate Minnesota.
And Madam Chair, that seems a little complicated, but it's the intention to create a two-pool idea of that. If that's
Representative Abler, I think some of us need that to be repeated, sure. If we could. Thanks, Ms. Larson.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members, on the document H3623DE3, page 1, line 23, after the period, insert the one-third and two-third allocations must be separately calculated for and distributed to the 7-county metropolitan area and outstate Minnesota.
Members, just in time, you'll have the pages coming around with a handwritten version of this in case you didn't catch it all. Representative Abler, any more comments to your
amendment? No, I'll move that amendment, Madam Chair.
Okay. That amendment, Representative Abler moves that amendment to be before the committee. Discussion to the amendment. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is really kind of picky, but the word outstate bothers me. Because you know what? I live in Hayfield. I'm not out of the state.
Yeah, you are.
And that's really picky, and I'm not offended. I just think we need to say non-metro or outside of or something. Like that.
Okay, I'll defer to council because oftentimes these things are defined in statute. Representative Larson, is there a? Okay. Does non-metro have a definition in statute that would define what we're talking about here?
And the rest of the state.
Okay, Representative Erickson, you have a suggestion?
Madam Chair and members, I would just delete outstate and put in the rest of the state or the remainder of the state.
Or Representative,
I want to go greater and lesser. So.
Representative Demmer, is it okay being called the remainder of the state?
And the remainder of Minnesota?
The remainder of Minnesota. I'm sure you're going to prefer greater.
But Madam Chair, I'm going to let that go.
Representative, Madam Chair, I think we could...
Representative Heidegger.
I think we could perhaps go, as Representative Sybil said, that the leftovers. That's usually what we get in outstate anyway.
I'm going to solve this. I think it might be outside the metro area. Outside the metro area of Minnesota would really get at what we're talking about. Outside the metropolitan area.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Larson says the non-metro might work.
I'll incorporate whatever we've decided. Madam.
Okay. So the simplest is to say non-metro. And the non-metropolitan area of Minnesota. Okay, the last line should read, in the non-metropolitan area of Minnesota, and I'll move that amendment to the amendment, or unless Representative Denner would like to move that. Okay, and Abler, Representative Abler will incorporate that. So now to the amendment. Anyone else like to speak to this amendment? Representative Erickson and then Representative Heidegger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Abler or Representative Maslow, do we have calculations as to how this separation now will affect the metro and the non-metro area?
Representative Abler?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, no, there is not. I think this is a policy committee and a policy question. I don't have any idea how this affects the runs, and I think it's better we don't have the runs in front of us. Sometimes we govern by runs, and we don't do the right thing. And this, the question on this part is it right to go to areas of greater need or not? That's what I hope we vote on when we get to the pure question of this. And taking away, I think the biggest losers, suffering the greatest amount of loss, were the people in the non-metro region. I don't think that that's equitable for them the way they suffer other kinds of loss. So I think when we get rid of that particular question, then we can ask the question, is it proper that we would go to the children that have the greatest amount of need? And so there's no run, and there won't be a run today. There'll be a run in finance, I'm sure, that they can calculate. But please vote on the policy matter.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, and
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Abler. I was not suggesting we shouldn't base this on need. I'm all for need. But, you know, that is a question that came up in this committee when we debated this bill last time. So I thought perhaps that had been prepared. Thank you. We'll wait for finance.
Representative Heidkirchen.
Thank you, yes, Madam Chair. And Representative Abler, you referred to the Senate where they're at with this bill, and I'm not understanding. Am I understanding right that the Senate is going with present law?
I can take that, Madam Chair, if you like.
Representative Meslow.
Madam Chair, Representative Heidkirchen, the Senate Early Childhood Bill does not change the existing Head Start formula.
Okay.
We do have a... go ahead, Representative Heidkirchen.
Thank you. And again, Representative Abler, so when I look at that, and I do look at numbers because they're very important to my districts, and the fact that we are so far behind the Wendy Anderson miracle right now, and taking any more monies away from rural Minnesota in any way, in any fashion, bothers me, and I have to defend my constituents back home. That's my job. But so what you're basically doing, you're taking the lump sum of money and dividing it up based on need, and you're dividing it up as it is presently divided up. Only thing, you're setting up two regions and based on need.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
Right, there's a change in the allocation formula. But at least this way it keeps the rural districts as a group will not lose a penny. And the metropolitan districts will not gain a penny or lose a penny. So they'll, as a group, as those two groups, they'll be determined the greatest need within those two groups. And so the rural, outstate Minnesota won't lose a penny.
Okay.
Representative Heidkirchen.
Thank you. And to that point, and I think that then apparently the beginning of the discussion is we need to define the word need before we go any further. As we had testimony from Washington County, the community action group over there, would be perhaps the largest recipient of these monies. They testified and said it would not be fair to pick one poor child over another. And if you look at the poorest county in the state of Minnesota, is up there in Todd County, pretty close to where Ben Norris and I are, Representative Norris, I look at Polk County as in the bottom four. They have a waiting list. But yet you want to take 8 slots away from Polk County, and I'll argue with anybody, the average income in Polk County is less than it is in Ramsey County. But yet at the same time, you want to give more slots to Ramsey County. So we need a definition of what is need. Before we go on, we can't go any place until we define what is needed. Are we going to take income averaging? I want to see the incomes. And I want to see the children that are waiting to be serviced by, you know, the Head Start program. And I think we need a definition of what is need.
Representative Freiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was raising my hand again. I forgot I was already on the list. Very fortuitous. Representative Heidkirchen, I definitely think that we should be allocating the Head Start slots based on need. And as you remember from a couple days ago, I did vote with you, even though I live in and represent Ramsey County. So I want to make it very clear that I'm not voting against Ramsey County slots to get 85 new slots for Head Start. The biggest gainer of this entire bill of Representative Meslow's is his county and mine. I did not vote with him, and it's not because of what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And I want to give you a better argument. The better argument is, and it was testified to by the Head Start people, and I hope we'll hear from them again, and that is because there are less opportunities if you don't get into Head Start in the rural area. You know, my area, we have learning ready. If you don't get into Head Start, you have some other things you can get into. Learning readiness is a good example. And I was told, and I hope that the Head Start people will tell us this again, if you don't get into Head Start in your area, Polk County or, you know, Menominee or whatever, then you're kind of screwed until you get to kindergarten. I'm sorry I used that word again. I think I used that last week. But, you know, I think that's a better argument that makes your case for need. Because if we get into metro-rural again today, mm-hmm. then I'm going to vote with Representative Meslow instead of you. Mm-hmm. So please don't do that.
To the Abler Amendment.
And Madam Chair.
Representative.
Madam Chair, to those comments.
To those comments, Representative Heidel.
Thank you, Representative Grimey, and I stand corrected. All right? And with that, and I Representative Sikora had mentioned last week, and I want to comment on it too, and I'll see, we do not have Head Start buses that I do see moving around the metro area. And that's another issue. Thank you.
Representative Demers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I maybe have to go back here a bit. We are talking about a statewide program. Representative Greiling makes an excellent point, and that's changing my thinking just a bit. But I guess from a factual standpoint, Representative Meslow, again, my understanding is we're not actually kicking kids who are on Head Start. We're not kicking them off to put somebody else on. We're saying, and I'm going to say the kind of the same example I used, I think, was it earlier this week or last week? I don't remember anymore. But
days have been running together lately.
You know, if I have slot, even the word slot even bothers me, but I'll just use it. If I have 30 slots available to me, and I have 20 kids, what happens to those 10 slots that I'm not using, Representative Meslow? What happens to the funding for those 10 slots I'm not using right now?
Representative Meslow.
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, those slots, the empty slots would still be funded to the mm-hmm. program, mm-hmm. even though only 20 of the 30. The program would be paid for 30 slots, even if 20 were filled.
Representative Demmer.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So if I understand, then I've got a Head Start program that is deemed to have 30 slots by the federal regulations. I'm getting money for 30 kids, whether I'm serving 30 or 10. I'm getting the same dollars. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
I think we have a testifier coming to the table who works with these programs. State your name for the record.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Michelle Weber with the Minnesota Department of Education. And Representative, currently the funding, both federal and state, is allocated on a formula, and the program is paid for their total allocation regardless of the number. There's no penalty if a program does not have a enrollment slot filled.
Okay, Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, this is helping me. I'm curious about, so bottom line is, if I've got a program out there with 30 slots, my dollars per child are higher the fewer kids that I have. And quite frankly, could be argued that there's a bit of an incentive to have fewer kids because I can do more for the kids I have than I realize it doesn't happen. So I guess what we're talking about here then is saying we're trying to even out on a statewide basis the dollars per child served as opposed to the dollars per child per eligible slot, if you will. Am I saying this the right way?
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair, Representative, currently there's not an incentive to serve fewer children because there would be a finding of noncompliance. There is not a financial penalty for that finding of noncompliance. So as a clarifying point, What happens is the funds are allocated to a program, and then the cost per child that has been established is divided into that allocation. Those are the number of children a program is expected to serve then.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could, so I have an understanding of this. So if I'm in a rural area where I've got transportation needs, and quite frankly, we do have Head Start buses in my area of the rural area. I see them out driving place to place. But is there a difference in the cost allocation for a rural area maybe that does have a larger area to serve than another area that maybe their costs to serve are lower, or the other way around, because of the cost of real estate, because of the cost of people? The bottom line is, if I've got a child served in Ramsey County, or if I got a child served in Dodge County, is there a difference in the allocation per child based on differences in costs?
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. An individual program has determined their cost per child through their application to the federal government for Head Start funds, and in taking into consideration to determine that cost per child, the grantee might, or the program might, consider things such as transportation, the geographic area served, the population concentration, things such as that. So that is why each program does have a different cost per child.
Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Nezzo. I just wanted to comment a little bit, on the need. We've been discussing that several times. In the rural areas, particularly in the one that I serve, there is a waiting list that does exist. There are a number of students and their families children and their families that are not served currently. Just one thing I would like to add to this. We don't have other programs readily available in our areas. And I don't want to make this a metro rail fight. I can see that that's really not productive. But on the other hand, as Representative Heidgerken said, we do need to speak up for the folks in our districts. One other interesting piece is about 3 weeks ago, I attended a judicial ride-along. I sat in on one of our child in need of protection, an afternoon of court cases. It was kind of a sobering time to be there. At any rate, just prior to going into that, the judge told me that the single thing that would be the most helpful to him in addressing these programs, or not programs, but cases, or reducing his caseload is actually what he meant, would be for us to help the early childhood programs. And seeing that we don't have many alternatives to Head Start in our area, and that Head Start works very well with the UCFEs, to me, I can only, take that to mean that we need to support our Head Start programs. And that's coming from the judicial segment of our area. I just wanted to bring that up.
Ms. Weber, is the availability and access to other programs any part of the definition of need?
Madam Chair, no, it is not.
Okay, thank you. Representative, to that point, though, but we also have Representative Dorn to that point first.
Representative Skorov.
Okay.
No, I was just curious. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Weber, don't we then, if that's what the judge wants, to serve more children, then don't we have to change the criteria, because we are serving the children that fall into that level of poverty that is eligible for Head Start? So wouldn't the federal criteria have to increase in order to do what the courts are saying they would like to do in her area?
Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think it would depend on the individual family need and whether or not they qualify for under the eligibility criteria. So I don't know that I could respond to that question universally.
Well, Madam Chair, Ms. Weber, I think Head Start's allowed to take about 10% additional children that don't meet the poverty criteria that have some other need. So that number would have to change if we are going to start taking more of those children. I'm just trying to understand that.
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair, Representative Sikora, yes, that's correct.
Okay. Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Weber, you referenced the issue of noncompliance. If I understood it correctly, there were empty slots beyond what the program had applied for or earned. Can you tell me how many of areas have been cited for noncompliance? Is that happening, or do we have waiting lists everywhere, so it's more theoretical than actual.
Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have specific numbers on findings of noncompliance. From our most recent program report data, we did find that 13 programs were under-enrolled, according to the federal definition of enrollment. And could you repeat the second part of your question, please?
Well, Madam Chair, that helps. I just wondered if it was actual or theoretical. And under-enrolled, if I can ask a quick follow-up, what would be the threshold of that? More than five slots unfilled, or is it a... I'm just trying to understand what noncompliance is.
Ms. Weber?
Madam Chair, Representative, the definition of under-enrolled is if a program has a vacancy for more than 30 days. So programs are allowed to, if a child were to leave the program, they're given 30 days to then fill that spot for, you know, by enrolling another child.
Thank you, ma'am.
Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a comment, the other bud talked about buses. We do have buses where I have a head start program in Otter Tail County, so I'm not sure how unique that is, but we do have buses.
Ms. Weber, are there counties that have no Head Start buses?
Madam Chair, I cannot answer that question. I don't know.
Okay. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And, you know, we've talked a lot about statistics and whatever, and even what the Representative Abler's amendment might do. But what I do know, and I guess what Representative Heidgerken was referring to, I've talked to my Head Start directors, I've talked to Head Start parents and others involved back in my community, and every single one of them says this would hurt their programs, their ability to serve students and children. I mean, that's the bottom line, is that I have heard no good on changing anything, and I don't even know what Representative Abler's would do exactly. But I guess one question, Madam Chair, that I have, why are we even looking at changing this? I mean, who's making the big push? Was it Head Start directors? Was it Head Start parents? I mean, why are we changing things? I mean, I kind of heard these things before, just like when they changed the allocation on seniors for nutrition programs, and even back in the local government aid debate, we had the state auditor come before us and saying all these people are talking, how we have to look at all. And I just want to know who these people are. I mean, who wants to make these changes? Who's pushing for this? Because I don't hear it. I'm hearing a lot of defense of the current system, but then... So.
Okay. Members, I'd like to remind you we are on the Abler Amendment, too, which is the amendment to take the, make it a metro versus not, and a non-metro, two separate pots of money, and it's so that we don't stray too much into just the general concept. Maybe we should stick to the Abler Amendment right now and vote on it. But I'll let Representative Mevlo respond to those comments first. And then we do have a testifier from the audience who would like to testify specifically to the Abler Amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Marquardt, this had its genesis in the Legislative Auditor's Report of 2001. And that report indicated that there was an imbalance in the level of service for the based on poverty level throughout the state of Minnesota, that the formula had been created in 1989, that in that time, because of shifts in the poverty level need around the state, that there was an imbalance there, that there were some programs that had more slots than they were able to fill. There were some programs that were underserved in the range of 4 to 6%, and there were some programs that were underserved in the range of 30 to 40%. And so the legislative auditor at that point recommended that that the formula be looked at again and that there be a new evaluation of that. It was in response to that recommendation of the auditor that the governor's proposal then came out and recommended that shift to base it entirely upon the level of poverty throughout the state. I think that, and I am frankly prepared to accept the will of the committee, whatever the committee would like to do on the Abler Amendment, but you'll recall that what happened last Friday is that we had a similar conversation, that a number of good points were raised on both sides, that it was at that time the will of the committee that the formula be changed to the 100% level. It's really based upon the things that I heard that day, ongoing discussions with members, and in particular suggestions that came from Representative Dorn, that the DE3 amendment now mitigates and reduces the level of change that would occur. And so it certainly is not my intention to be punitive with it in this. And in fact, I could have said, well, I'm just going to sit on the vote that already happened last Friday. And instead, I'm trying to address those concerns. I'm not saying that this is a finished document. We're continuing to work on that. But I recognize the concerns that you have expressed, the concerns, Representative Saylor, that you've addressed. And I would note that when we talk about a focus and priority of let's make sure that we're serving kids, remember that this bill, as it stands now, would put an additional $7 million into early childhood programs, and that's going to be across the state. So I appreciate the members who voted against the motion to table, because that would have killed that $7 million. And I guarantee that when you look at what's going to come out of that Head Start money, it will exceed any losses that people are going to, that any program would have under the Head Start reallocation. So when you look at the bill as a package, it will be a net positive throughout the state.
Ms. Doblin, can you send your testifier down to testify to the Abler Amendment? Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Gail Kelly. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Head Start Association, and I live in Duluth, Minnesota. But I'm not sure if that's Metro now or not. Anyway, it's been a fast-paced 2 weeks. Ever since the press release came out on the governor's initiative, we were quite surprised. We were thinking we would be testifying about Head Start Child Care Partnerships, and very excited if we have an opportunity to come. But today I'd like to speak to the Abler Amendment, and I thank you for this opportunity. And I thank Representative Abler for mentioning that this is important policy work that we're doing here today. And policy work takes time and thoughtfulness. The changes that we've discussed, and they're not on the statute, not only affect the funding formula, they affect what grantees would receive state funds, they have changes in how we would pay for services, and changes in language about innovative funding. It takes more than a few advocates like me sitting down with the Department of Education to make wise decisions about those changes. We really welcome the opportunity to study this, and we've mentioned to Representative Meslow that we would like to work with the department, a group of stakeholders and legislators, to really look at these issues carefully instead of doing it in a fast-paced session. I want to speak to the formula for a moment. In 1989, when the legislature, this body, decided on the funding formula, it was a very thoughtful decision. Remember, they were supplementing $82 million that the grantees brought in federal funds. Those grantees wrote grants and competitively compete for funds on the federal level to bring directly to their local communities. And the state government wanted to supplement that to get more children served in Head Start. We commend the state legislature, and again, you are a model among states, and we really appreciate that. The formula was set up to make programs continue to compete for their federal funds, and that's the reason that the federal share was included in that allocation. That also was based on unmet need, and as you are aware, that only 42% of the unmet need across the state was this being served with federal and state dollars. So it provided a consistent funding effort to add about 2,700 children to the formula to serve classrooms. Shifting this money around would have real impacts for local communities. It means a family that now is currently has a 5-year-old or 4-year-old in the program, but one that's ready to come in will not probably receive that service. It means making decisions about classrooms And when you close classrooms, that often has impacts for facilities and the rent that we pay for facilities. It means partnerships. Out in outstate Minnesota, tremendous partnerships between ECFE, Head Start, early childhood special education, depend on those slots for in our Head Start partnerships. And also, most of all, it means communities. In many of our rural communities, there's no alternatives for families living in poverty that have young children. This family development program is critical. We understand the other concerns that have been mentioned. I want to just make a point. When we talk about enrollment in Head Start, we currently have funded to serve 14,000 children. We actually serve 17,000 children. Now, how does that happen? Well, when a slot is given to a community and a child is filled in that slot, we provide all the necessary services. This is a very mobile population. When they move away because of housing or other concerns, we have 30 days to put another child in that slot. In many cases, particularly in the tribal programs, reporting that information becomes cumbersome. You have to add the number of children that are actually there, plus those that have been there, slots that are open for more than for less than 30 days. So when the Department of Education ran their analysis using the PIR data, the Program Information Report, I asked them to share that with grantees. I hope that's been done, because that was just a current analysis that was run. Because it's very important that we find out if that's a reporting problem or if that has to do with actual slots that are not being filled in 30 days, in which case oftentimes it's having to mobilize the waiting list quickly in Badger, where you may have kids in Roseau. But again, we can address that problem. I'm confident that the 2% of slots, those children in those slots that on that PIR data were reported as unenrolled or under-enrolled, could be addressed just working with the state Head Start monitors that we currently have at the Department of Education. Again, as I mentioned, we're also concerned about innovative funding.
Ms. Kelly, is this directly, though, to the splitting it up between metro and non-metro? If you could kind of keep your arguments to that.
Thank
we
you.
Really need to deal with this specific amendment right now.
Thank you. I guess then in closing, I would say that we have 35 Head Start programs in Minnesota, and they're all willing to address the concerns about looking at this policy and making changes. We want to work with Representative Meslow. All 35 programs, winners and losers in this proposal, have stand united that we are not about changing the formula at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly. Representative Greiling, you're on the list. You have a...
Madam Chair, mine is not to this amendment, but okay. What my question was, and it might affect Ms. Kelly, I wanted to find out if she could give us more information on the rural options versus metro options. So maybe we could hear from her after we vote on the amendment.
Okay. Are there any questions for Ms. Kelly that would be specific to the Abler amendments? Representative Dorn.
Madam Chair, let me try one. although I will confess that the more I hear about this, I think the less I know, and hopefully finish sooner, I won't know anything. I'm looking at what we did a few days ago to Minnesota Valley Action Council. As I see it under current law, there's a 4.7% of unmet need, and the bill as it came to us based on 100% unmet need, they would gain, I think, 13 slots, about $73,000. But I heard the testimony, and I heard that wasn't right, so I voted not to do that, or with the Saylor Amendment to go back to current law. After that, I thought, well, if the votes are here for making the change, maybe I could modify the change. So I asked somebody, what would it look like if we did a two-thirds, one-third, rather than 100% over? Because I wondered if that would be, you know, better than just a total change. That improves, but the Minnesota Valley Action Council, the Mankato area basically, still would gain about four slots and 23,000. What would happen under the Abler Amendment if we're rearranging what's happening in 80 counties? You know, what And again, I'm not voting according to what the runs say, because I voted against what the runs said. But I'm trying to understand if in reconfiguring this, we don't create just a different problem than the one we're hearing about. That's what I want to know.
Ms. Kelly.
Representative, Madam Chair and committee members, I have no idea what would happen. Every time, I get a new run or I look at these new numbers, I'm looking at the bigger implications, to be honest, Representative Dorn. And I'd like to look at that carefully so that we don't do something that will jeopardize our communities and this all fits together. As I said, there's multiple changes in this bill. And we would love to sit down and study this, like Community Ed did when they changed their formula, had a work group, and really thoughtfully thought about how we do it. The next dollar of Head Start, state Head Start money that you allocate, I want to make sure, we all want to make sure, it serves the greatest unmet need. But when we're talking about existing dollars and programs in mid-grant year, remember, this is not the new biennium. This is in the mid-grant cycle that we're making these changes. And I have no idea how that would impact.
Is there any more discussion to this amendment? Representative Lass, is it to this amendment, the Abler amendment?
Well, I'm trying to understand exactly the implications of the Abler amendment. I'm still not sure I've got that clear. So,
are you looking for specific runs?
Yeah, I think I probably am. And I reject the notion that it's just a question for K-12 finance. For one thing, I'm not on K-12 finance, so I won't see this question. But secondly, funding has massive policy implications. And I think we ought to have that information before we make an important policy decision.
Representative Abler, do you have any specific runs for Representative Latz?
Madam Chair, I'd be willing to run and go try to find some runs. But but just to the point of this, I think this is the discussion would have happened with the amendment or without the amendment. So I think we're talking about the question of how to do this and how shall we do it. I wasn't here on Friday, so I didn't get to hear the discussion, and now I got to hear all the discussion, and you all got to hear it twice, I think. But I think this is an important matter, and I think that what my amendment would serve you would be to mitigate major changes if we do it at all this year. I think that the advocates, I think, agree it's worth looking into. That's a valid point. And this would soften any blow and in any major shifts. So if you think we should talk about it some more, about making some changes, this would make the blow softer. And so that's the question that is being asked. And so in terms of a mid-year change, so that's the best I can tell you.
Representative Olson, to this amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Abler, is it not safe to say that your amendment prevents any shifting from rural to metro and metro to rural, and all shifting would occur in the rural area and in the metro area?
Mm-hmm. Representative Abler.
That's exactly what the amendment would do.
Yeah. Representative Latz.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Olson. That does help clarify for me. And frankly, I would think within the metro area, people in various population centers ought to be concerned about what the effect would be sending money from Rochester to Winona, or whatever the changes might be as a result of this amendment. But I think we are back, and we are making confronting a policy decision similar to the one that we discussed last week. Representative Neslo has come forward with a smaller move in the direction of addressing pure need, as Representative Erickson said she supports, just dealing with it purely on a need base. And Representative Abler's amendment would even make that move smaller. The fact is the existing formula disproportionately benefits the rural greater Minnesota, non-metro portion of Minnesota, whatever language you want to use. There is frankly greater need proportionally in the metro area than there is in the non-metro area for these Head Start funds. And I don't know exactly how to balance the availability of alternative programs, but if we're meeting 25% of the unmet need in Polk County and we're meeting 10% of the unmet need in Hennepin County,
then we've got a far greater proportion of unmet need in Hennepin County than they have in Polk County. Now, is that equitable? Is that fair? Are those kids any less deserving in Hennepin County than the kids in Polk County? I think it's high time that we reconfigure the formula to more accurately reflect where the need is. If you're going to factor in only income, I don't think that's fair either, Representative Heidgerk. And the cost of living is a lot lower where you live than it is where I live. I have to pay a lot more for my house proportionately than you do for yours. The cost of living is different. I probably pay more for a quarter pounder with cheese than you do in your area. And so I think, you know, the existing formula already needs to be changed. Representative Abler's amendment would further move us, I think, back in the wrong direction. We made a decision last week which I thought was the right decision on the merits. I know others disagree with me on this, but if we're going to be doing this fairly based on need, then we ought to do that. At least Representative Neslow's bill tries to find some middle ground. Moving even further in that direction, as Representative Abler suggests, I think, ends up pitting more communities against more communities that we probably shouldn't pit.
It's clear, members, that we are ready to have a discussion on this section of the bill, and I would like to move... Representative Heidgerk and Representative Latz has gotten into the discussion of the policy.
And I want to rebut that he brought in my district personally.
And I'm going to let you do that as soon as we take a vote on the amendment.
It has to do with this amendment.
Okay, Representative Heidgerk.
Okay, again, Representative Latz, you missed the earlier discussion that we had on this particular issue. Representative Greiling brought it up very well, that it isn't just a Head Start program. There are other programs available in your area that are not available in mine. The only program I have available is the Head Start program. There's a big difference in monies there. As to whether or not there is, if you want to talk about incomes, a dollar is a dollar. The cost of living, the price of food is the same in my district as it is in yours. Even though you may have a house that may be valued a lot higher, the percentage of taxes paid in any house in my district on a percentage basis is just as high as yours.
No.
But we can start arguing about gas is the same, everything else is the same, so we don't get into that. But it's an issue of fairness here. You're saying that my poor person has greater needs than your poor person, and it's not that way. I have no other place to go. You've got other programs available. This is the only program I have available. And I have right now a waiting list in Polk County to get into this program. They're not all getting in. And I know that this issue was never really discussed as to where are the under-enrolled districts, and I think there's some in the metro area. If that is true, then I think Representative Abler has a very, very, very good approach, at least to the problem of taking care of at least within certain regions. But we can go back and forth on this, but if we want to get into the arguments on where the real poor people are, the poorest counties, again, as I mentioned, are Todd County is the poorest county in Minnesota.
Representative Heidgerk, thank you for those comments, but we'll have to keep the whole state in mind. It might be a surprise to you that I have one of the top ten poorest cities in my district, and so I think we all have a stake in this particular argument. Representative Ava, would you like to renew your motion for your amendment? Okay. All those in favor of the Ava amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail. Now we're going to move to the
Madam Chair.
Whole amendments. Yes, Representative. Yeah.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move reconsideration of the Heidgerk motion by which we voted on earlier today.
Okay. We're reconsidering tabling the bill. That's not a debatable motion, so we'll take a vote on that right now. All those in favor of tabling this bill, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
No.
Division.
division being called. Raise your hand if you support tabling this bill. Okay, thank you. All those opposed, raise your hand. With 16 voting in favor of tabling the bill and 8 voting against, this bill is now put on the table. Members, there must be a good party tonight because we now have nothing else on our agenda. And Representative Dabney's motion has freed us up, so this committee is now adjourned. Thanks.